Let's take a quick look at Exodus 3, at least to kind of begin to preview this in anticipation of where we're going next. And once again, we have the beginning of a narrative. Now, Exodus 3, there's a reason we're picking what we're picking to read. Exodus 3 is a fairly significant chapter. Has a lot to do with not only the narrative, the storyline of the Pentateuch, but of course is the key text for the revelation of the divine name, as you well know. Have any of you done Exodus 3 already in a readings course? A few of you have, okay. As you know, Exodus sort of picks, where are we when we begin Exodus, to do a little isagogics here? What's happened? The promise to Abraham to be a great goy in a land finds him in the wrong place. Now what happens early on in the book of Exodus is that they do become numerous in number, so they've kind of become a big goy. So that part of Genesis 12 is fulfilled. The problem is that they're in the wrong place. So the story of Exodus is really getting them from the wrong place to the right place. Even though they've become a numerous and large in number, they have to succumb to what really was social persecution. They just, when the minority starts becoming equal or greater than the majority of people, social issues get a little dicey. And that's essentially what's going on here. And we all know what happens when a new king arose who did not know Joseph. So what's neat about chapter 2 is that God sort of hears their cry. And what we have in chapter 3 is sort of a new beginning to the story, but it's still part of the story. This is a lot like the introduction to Genesis chapter 2, where the wow consecutive is broken by a subject with the verb in the perfect. And Moses was, with the participle roe. And Moses was, suddenly we got Moses on our hands. Just like in Genesis 2, suddenly, or Genesis 3, did I say 2? Genesis 3, suddenly we have a snake on our hands. So suddenly the story sort of shifts and, well, wait a minute, now how does Moses fit into all of this stuff? So here's Moses now, and Moses was shepherding. You see, this is an odd expression to use the verb to be plus what's roe. I know you didn't prepare this. This is just kind of getting going. Roe is a participle, cow participle of the third hey ra'ah. You know the ra'ah that means to see, with an aleph. This is ra'ah with an ayin that means to shepherd. If there were a verb in English to shepherd, this would be it, to act as shepherd. Yahweh is my ro'i, or Yahweh ro'i is my shepherding one, is my shepherd. I shall not want, Psalm 23. But to use this with the verb to be is kind of awkward. You could have just said in Moses, you could have used an imperfect vowel consecutive of to shepherd, right? Moses was acting as shepherd, probably highlighting the fact that this was his job. It's not just that he was out one day doing this, but this is what he was doing as his career at this point. He kind of had a three-career, didn't he? And Moses was shepherding the tzon, the flock of Yitro, personal name, his katon, his kotein, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he drove, nahag, you can, it's easy to parse, you just don't necessarily know it. He drove the sheep, achar, behind the wilderness. This is the geographical use of achar. If you're headed, if you're oriented correctly, or as they say, orientated correctly, you should be facing east. That's what orient means. Which means, what's behind you? West. So achar as the sort of the position compass point of west is related to that sense of the orientation and compass points. So it's not so much behind the wilderness, but probably west of the wilderness. What would be real nice, again, we're doing interpretation the minute you go beyond just translating, I suppose, is to know exactly where we are, but we don't. They sort of assume that you're a little bit of an insider to the geography here. Moses was acting as shepherd, the flock of Jethro, in, where was I, second line. And he drove the flock, achar, west of the wilderness, and Yavo, and he came to Har HaElohim. Note the article on Elohim, probably that definite use. This is, first of all, the way to make a construct change definite. So it's not a mountain of God, but the mountain of God. If you want to say the mountain of God, you got to put the on God. You can't put it on the construct noun. That's the rules. I sometimes wonder, too, if Ha Elohim tends to emphasize the God as opposed to gods. It's hard to prove that necessarily, but usually when we talk about the God, it's singular, and it's almost a way of capitalizing it, which, of course, you can't do in Hebrew. There's another word for hill. So this is the word for mountain. And you see, again, there's sort of an assumption here that we know what mountain this is. It's the mountain of God. I mean, what mountain is this? This is Sinai, or at least he's in the wilderness of Sinai. I mean, a lot of sort of Bible students don't realize that when we get to Sinai in Exodus 19, Moses has already been there, done that. This is the completion. In fact, doesn't he say that this will be the sign to you, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, that you will worship God on this mountain. So getting back to Sinai is part of the sort of the first fulfillment of how this is supposed to work. Was there another hand? Literally, you can certainly translate this, the mountain of the God. Yeah. And it's kind of clumsy, but you can make the case. And then you have in apposition, Horeva, which is in fact Horeb plus directive hay. This is an unaccented comet's hay is directive hay. So to the mountain of God, if you didn't know it, now he tells you this is Horeb, which is another name for Sinai. Now again, JEDP assumes that Horeb is the D word and Sinai is the P word. And again, this is indicative of two different ways of talking about the mountain tradition. It could well be that they're just two names for the same place, that one is more the range, one is more the mountaintop, but they're almost interchangeably to Horeb. And Yerah Malach Yahweh. Now this is rich here. The Malach Yahweh, can you parse Yerah? If not, do it by Friday. This is a nice example of the so-called blessed Niphal. Oh, blessed Niphal. Some people have other adjectives less blessed than blessed, but you can parse it out. Blessed Niphal, and it's very common with Ra'ah. This is the other Ra'ah. This is the Ra'ah to see, but in the Niphal, it usually means, see, it's sort of this intransitive appear. You could argue be seen as a pure passive. The Niphal is probably sort of reflexive here too. I love this translation, and this is what they kind of mean by a blessed Niphal, that this stuff sort of happens in the medial passive. That God let himself be seen. You don't really see God. God allows himself to be seen. But it's not just purely passive either. He allows himself. I always do this for Bible class. If you got little kids, we have a house that has a circle in it. You know, you can go from the kitchen to the dining room to the living room to the front hall to the kitchen to the dining room to the living room to the front hall. When your kids are little and they start, you play hide and seek, right? And you're standing there next to the piano and the kid's going around the room and around the room and around the room. And finally, you step out from the piano, and the kid comes around and, bam, runs right into you. And what does the kid say? I found you, Daddy. This is a blessed Niphal. You sort of got in the way and allowed yourself to be found. Now, sort of phenomenologically, the child doesn't get it, right? This is like we accept Jesus Christ or something. Well, it's not really that way. It happens to us. You see, there's an agent that isn't always made clear. The Malach Yahweh is for all. This is the famous Malach Yahweh, the messenger angel of Yahweh, who is a lot like Yahweh, except it's the messenger of Yahweh. So which is it, Yahweh or something distinct from Yahweh? Not clear. I'll just leave it at that for now. We just want to tickle a little bit here. So the Malach Yahweh appeared to him in a tongue or flame of fire from the midst of the Sneh. This is the bush. And he saw the Hine. And what? He noticed? Hine is just used here as an attention getter, which is exactly what Hine is. And he looked and Guess what? I mean, how do I translate this? Behold is probably okay, but it really doesn't communicate, all right? And my favorite translation for Hine would be something like, looky here. Guess what? Look what you got. Hine always grabs you by the shoulders and says, there's something here. You got to pay attention to it. Look at this. Right? It's kind of getting your attention. And he looked and, wow, the bush was Boer Ba'esh. The bush was Boer, participle. Burning Ba'esh, literally in the fire. Vahasne, and the bush Einenu Ukal. Oh, baby. This is vintage Hebrew. This is, again, you can talk about this on Friday. Look it up. This is Ein plus the pronominal suffix Enu, which is really from who as an ending, right? So it's the third singular masculine. It's non-existence. That's what it means. Ein means non-existence. We ran through this, I think, was that in our class last Friday, the four negative words, and I said Ein is always used with nominal or verbless sentences, usually a participle. And here's a classic example of how it's negating a verbless sentence. And the bush was burning, and its notness was ukal. Ukal looks like, well, it looks like a pool, doesn't it? But it's really not. If you want to know, this is a little secret. The ukal is actually a kal passive participle. That is to say, you know that there was a kal passive conjugation. Do you know this? If not, here's the straight story. All right. There used to be a kal and a kal passive. So there's a participle that's a passive participle of the kal, but it's probably better. And the forms here are a bit mysterious because you've got your katul form, you have your kutal form, which is this one, and you actually also have a kitol form, which is another a variant of this kal passive participle. And the reason we're not sure of how it's pointed is because the Masoretes didn't know how it was pointed. The kal passive was a conjugation. In addition to the kal, you had kal passive, and then you had nifal as the reflexive of your three basic stem system. Have you done the tic-tac-toe chart? You know what I'm talking about? You have your basic system, you have your D system or intensive system, and you have your causative or H system. Each system has an active, a passive, and a reflexive. The only one that's complete is the D system, the intensive, where you have P-A-L, Pru-A-L, Hith-P-A-L. There you got all three. Transitive or active, passive, and reflexive. Theoretically, you had the same three in the kal or the basic system. The kal, which is active, the kal passive, which is passive, and the nifal, which is reflexive. And the kal passive kind of fell out of use, went extinct, except for a few extant forms, and this happens to be one of them. We know this because ukal doesn't occur in the pl. This can't really be a pl form. So it's got to be passive. It's a kal passive. Well, that's just a quick excursus on that, and we're over time, but at least we got going into the first couple verses. See what you can we'll get through the sort of the first half of this on Friday. We'll do the whole thing next Tuesday. We'll finish it again next Friday. That's kind of a nice rhythm.